Are you annoyed by the homeless? Do you fear becoming homeless yourself? This is the local brown bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. On April 19, 2009, we saw a brand new light on the homeless people of this city and Vancouver Island. It all came into focus on the first ever film festival devoted to movies about the homeless. It was called Real Justice, R-E-E-L, Justice, presented by the hardworking Pivot Society and Simon Fraser University. Two CFRO hosts, Alex Smith and Allert, went for the event. Alex recorded the academic panel from Sunday afternoon, including Professors Pendekour, Patterson, and Hebert. Meanwhile, Allert interviewed filmmakers. Her moving conversation with Harold C. Joe, producer of the movie Broken Down, was broadcast on Radio EcoShock on Friday, April 24th. You can download that interview from ecoshock.org. Next, Allert had a heart-to-heart with Judy Graves, the Tenant Assistance Coordinator at City Hall. Judy has been working to help the disadvantaged and the homeless since the mid-1970s. She has seen it all, and yet was so moved by the plight of women in one film she had to leave the room for a minute. Allert asks Judy Graves what, from the film It Was a Wonderful Life by Michelle Ohion, stirred it up. Here is Allert, host of the Dynamic Health Radio Show.
I'm here with Judy Graves, who is the coordinator of the Tenant Assistant Program at City Hall. Judy, how long have you been doing that?
I've been working in this program since, I think, 1991, and with the street population since 1974.
And now we just saw a film earlier about the invisible homeless women that are in, you know, everywhere or across the country. What you seemed visibly moved by that when you were up on the panel after that. Could you tell us your reactions?
Yes, I found the film so distressing. It's not the first time that I've seen it, but this afternoon I had to walk out and sort of pull myself together for a bit. The film is called It Was a Wonderful Life, and it is about middle-class and upper-middle-class women who are now homeless in Los Angeles. It was made there in 1991, but could be made almost identically today in Vancouver.
And what was it that got you all stirred up today?
Because it is so frequent that wonderful women are discarded by their partner, by family, find themselves struggling to remain in the workforce once they get into their 50s. And what appeared to be a very secure life suddenly leaves them homeless. And I think all of us know women this has happened to. As you watch the movie, you become alert to more and more situations, more and more people who are around you, who are in fact passed from pillar to post, either sofa surfing, crashing with their children, living out of their cars, or maybe looking after other people's places while those people are on vacation, one after another, until they can't find another place to care for. And perhaps all women, as we move through midlife, become afraid that this will happen to us too.
And what's interesting also is that the women that were homeless didn't look like what most people would think of as homeless. The visible homeless that's on the street, the drug addicts, the people who are panhandling, that sort of thing. They were women that you wouldn't necessarily know are homeless from looking or talking with them.
That's right. These are women who have impeccable manners, pay great attention to their grooming and their appearance, make sure that they have showers. You could notice even, I think of one woman wearing a beautiful Diane von Furstenberg wraparound dress, and yet a very cheap pair of shoes that she'd clearly bought in her state of poverty and badly needing a haircut. But Perhaps most people who are homeless don't fit the stereotype. Most people who are homeless are not addicted, are not mentally ill, but are desperately poor.
Now, you just before this question, too, you said about the age and wondering if this could possibly happen to other women. Could you talk a little bit about age and the opportunities for women who are older trying to pull themselves out of that kind of scenario?
It's very difficult for older women. It's difficult enough to remain in the workforce as an older woman competing against young men. To find a job when you're over 50 is difficult for both men and women, but perhaps much harder for women who, in that generation, in their 50s and 60s, were raised with the expectation of being homemakers and not participants in a workforce, and may not have the kind of work skills that are readily received, or may have high levels of education, a past of professional employment, and be seen as overqualified for any available work.
And then also the situation gets complicated if they have children. So there was a woman who left, her husband left her with six children. She had been a professional singer. He thought that she should be a homemaker, so she gave up her career to do that. And then down the line, he dumped her with her, well, she was pregnant with her sixth child, and then didn't pay child support, and she was in a completely devastated situation.
Here she was, completely devastated. He had left her with this, with her children. She had found a house to rent. As long as the child support was coming in, she was able to manage. But when he decided to put the money into his BMW rather than into his children, they all lost their home. There was really no quick way for her to start over again.
Now, you see these kinds of situations in your work. What kind of impact does this have on the children?
It has a devastating impact on the children. Children who are frequently moved don't get to continue a school year in one school. We know of children in Vancouver who move about every 3 months and may go to three different schools in every school year. They don't make friends. They are recipients of bullying. They don't get involved in clubs, in sports, in other activities that would be normal for children their age, and are at high risk for any kind of problems that a child could develop during adolescence.
And what are the risks, too, of the children being taken away from the mother if she's homeless, whether that be taken away by the, you know, authorities, the city, just because she's homeless, or being taken away from by a father who's using her situation to gain custody of the children?
All parents who are homeless live in terror that their children will be taken from them, and this impairs their ability to parent as well. A person needs to be secure in their right to parent, and children need to be secure in their right to stay with their parent. We have seen the Ministry of Children and Families threaten to take children away from women who were living in single rooms, and to take away a child because the parent is poor is terribly cruel. We know that children raised in foster care are at great risk of homelessness as adults, and to create homelessness by taking children from their parents generation after generation is mindless and cruel.
Now, I noticed in this film, too, that there was a reluctance on the part of many of these women to accept any kind of social assistance, welfare, whatever. It seemed like to do so would be an admitting that they're getting pulled farther into the pit and that they're losing their dignity and their independence even further. Do you have some comments about that?
Yes, I think most people have an aversion to accepting social assistance. And, you know, for people who have worked, for women who have been upper middle class, it is a terrifying admission that they no longer hold the position that they held in society before. There is a fear of getting out of a welfare situation. And there is also the degradation of being treated very badly by welfare workers.
And women that end up in these situations, is it one thing leads to another, and do they sort of spiral down and down deeper into the pit?
Most women at some point manage to get out of the situation, and it's a real testimony to their strength and their perseverance that they do. However, the situation, a woman living in her car at some point won't be able to pay for the insurance, then the car will be towed, she will lose the car, she will at that point either have to start living outside in the streets or falling into the shelter system and the residential hotels. The further down a person goes, the more difficult it is to get out.
And typically, as they are experiencing this, you find that their health also goes down because they are dependent upon others, perhaps for food. They're not making their own food choices, so they can't maybe choose healthier foods. And does that then lead them into a deeper pit?
Well, we know that the determinants of health, the most basic determinants of health, are nutrition, water, clean air, and housing. And a person who is homeless has access on a regular basis to none of those, has no control over whether they get housing, whether they can live in clean air, whether they can access even the simplest things like drinking water or nutritious food. And of course, people's health goes down.
And what is the state of the support system for people?
The support system, unfortunately, kicks in after a person becomes homeless. We would like to see rent banks so that a person who needs a month or two of financial assistance to stay in their home, well, they try desperately to get back into a job while they find some way of regaining stability. A rent bank might allow that to happen much more frequently, and to not support children until the family lands on welfare rather than an unemployment system such as we used to have that would kick in and support the family before they lost their housing, before they began the state of perpetual transition, would be much more helpful.
And so is it a lack of funding, a lack of initiative that this is not happening?
It is to some extent a lack of political will, and political will always put the funding where it's most needed. I think that our politicians don't recognize the problem, that our senior bureaucrats are themselves isolated from the problem, that until people are sensitized to it with movies like the one we saw today, many people don't even recognize this terrible problem when they're living right next door to it.
Now, when you say that the politicians are not necessarily aware, what kind of efforts have been made to make them aware?
There's certainly been a number of reports done in Canada that should have made their way up the bureaucracy, constituency assistance to MLAs and MPs frequently work with women who are becoming homeless. And many levels of government work concerning the lack of child support payments being made, and yet there is no cohesive work being done throughout the system to make sure that homelessness is not the end result.
Is it, do you think that they just don't care? I mean, especially if efforts have been made and they obviously have some awareness of it. Is it just that their priorities are elsewhere? May I suggest that perhaps they're more concerned about having the flow of money go up towards corporations and incentive programs and bailouts and this and that than to the homeless population?
This is certainly the concern, and it may be the reality. I think we all bear some of the responsibility that we need to recognize the problem among us and with our friends and with our families. And then we need to be articulating it loudly through the media to the politicians, and demanding change with our votes.
And how are we all complicit in the problem?
I think that there's something terrible in human nature that makes it very difficult to hear other people going through problems. We want to deny that it's happening. We want to pull away from it. And often the person who is going through the situation articulates their problem over and over and over without it ever being fully taken in, even by their own family and friends. I think we do this because we're afraid that the same thing will happen to us in some way we don't want to know. But if we are going to protect ourselves and each other, we have to know.
And I just want to touch a little bit on the potential for violence or the vulnerability to violence that these women find themselves in. Certainly if they're living in their car, they are more vulnerable to violence. If they've left an abusive environment, or perhaps they are not leaving an abusive environment because they don't want to be homeless, how does violence factor in?
Violence factors in totally. Anytime someone is moved down the social hierarchy, they are made more vulnerable to violence. Women who live outside are frequently raped. Women who live in their cars are raped. Women who sofa surf are raped. Vulnerable to violence. And it is not unusual for women to be put in a situation where they have to exchange sex for a place that's warm and safe to sleep. So while she may be staying with a friend, this is not a friend with whom she would normally choose as a sexual partner. But because of the proximity, because of the ambiguous dynamic of sharing a base, it becomes a sexual relationship which does violence to her soul because it was not chosen.
And more impetus to go downward into this spiral. And then the depression and all of this. We want to talk about the state of mind that happens to women. Depression, is that a huge problem?
Depression is a huge problem. When you do listen on a daily basis, as I do, to women who are going through this, the actual surprise is that there are not more who are severely depressed, that something in them continues to fight to regain some form of a decent life. Once someone is encapsulated in depression, they do, in fact, become very homeless or hopeless. And that takes away the momentum to fight, leaving them almost certainly homeless for a long time.
What would you want us to know that you think is really important about this issue?
I want people to know that all women in middle age are terrified of becoming homeless. Oprah is afraid of becoming homeless. That it is something that has been on the periphery of our consciousness. We have seen our aunties, our mother's friends, now our friends, going through states which in the middle class are not named as homelessness, but in fact where a woman does not have a place of her own, does not have her own furniture, does not hang her own pictures on the walls, is not safe or stable in her environment. That fear in us is what we need to empower us to fight against this for change, and for change right across the system, so that people are not precipitated into homelessness.
What do you think about typical media stereotypes, TV, film, how they portray women? Certainly quite often, even the advertising says to women, be young, be pretty, be concerned about color in your hair and your makeup. That's where your concerns should be. The stereotype of men being that they should be successful, and they should be tough, and they should handle problems with violence, be tough guys. Do you think that these stereotypes feed into what you were just talking about as far as women's fear of becoming, you know, past their 30s and then be disposable, because that's the representation certainly in the film and TV industry as well as advertising?
Well, exactly. Our social housing is filled with older women. Women who do not have pensions, women who do not have savings, women who do not have access to property of their own. And this has happened because women's wages have always been and continue to be lower than men's, because women are more vulnerable in the court system when it comes to splitting assets in a divorce, because it is very difficult to collect child support payment, and often very difficult to fight for child support payments. You know, the when a woman moves through her 40s, she becomes aware of how much she has been taught to use her youth, her beauty, and her child-rearing to form a relationship with a man who will look after her. And that happens still in this new millennium. When childbearing youth and beauty are no longer there, and women are extremely vulnerable. And, you know, if the media would focus their attention on the smart women who know where the bank accounts are, the smart women who have tucked some money aside, the smart women who have their own lawyers, we might do a little better.
Do you have some final words to leave us with?
I think it's going to be a long struggle. I think we became aware of this in the 1960s with the early feminists, with Betty Friedan. That was my mother's fight. The 70s was my fight. There are still huge fights for young women who have been encouraged to stay away from union jobs. Unions have been broken. They have been encouraged to go into entrepreneurial work, contracting, which has left them completely and utterly vulnerable, with no pensions, with no ability to save an income as they lurch from contract to contract. And it's something we all have to wake up and take a look at.
Thank you very much. That was a very informative interview, Judy.
Thank you very much.
I was speaking with Judy Graves, who is the coordinator of the Tenant Assistance Program at City Hall. My name is Ellard.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. We're talking about the homeless as presented at the recent Real Justice Film Festival at the downtown campus of Simon Fraser University, along with the Pivot Society and a neat team of downtown youth. They worked so hard.
Okay, I'm back talking with Judy Graves. This is Allert. Judy Graves is the coordinator of Tenant Assistant Program at City Hall. I had some further questions of Judy, and we were talking about health impacts and water access for homeless people. Could you relay what we were talking about?
Sure. It's... I think I need some water. When you or I come down with pneumonia, we might go to an emergency room, get a chest x-ray, and be given a prescription and be discharged. The whole process will take 3 or 4 hours. When a homeless person who is not on welfare gets pneumonia, they might go to an emergency room in the hospital. They'll get a chest x-ray and a paper prescription for antibiotics, and they'll be discharged in the same 3 or 4 hours that we were. But you and I go home, probably driven by a friend. We're tucked in bed while our friend runs out and buys our antibiotics for us and comes and makes sure we've got chicken soup and orange juice, yeah, and water. If you're homeless, you walk dizzy with the fever out of the hospital, you look for a doorway, you curl up in the doorway, and you go to sleep. Nobody brings you water. You lie there in the doorway with your high fever and dehydrate until probably an ambulance comes and takes you back to the hospital, in which case you'll be rehydrated and placed back on the street. The hospitals say that homelessness is a social problem, not a medical problem. But being without water, sleeping on a sidewalk in the same level as the fumes come out of cars, that is a medical problem when you're ill. And there is no convalescent care for people who are very ill. The hospital social worker may try to send them to a shelter, but in the shelter they'll be sharing a room or sharing a barrack with many other homeless people and will be coughing all over them, and the pneumonia spreads through the shelter, no one getting well. People who remain in the street remain somewhat infected with pneumonia month in, month out, year in, year out. And it is why you sometimes see them walking so slowly and having trouble getting up hills.
Could you talk about the difficulty in getting water?
When you're in the street, if you look stereotypically homeless, you don't have access to the water sources the rest of us would use. If I were thirsty, it's a hot summer day, we can go into a coffee shop and either buy something to drink, or even because we look relatively nice, could ask for a drink of water and would probably be given one. If you look stereotypically homeless, if you smell stereotypically homeless, you are not going to be welcome in a coffee shop. You won't be welcome going into a mall to access water in the washroom or in a department store. And it becomes very difficult to find water. When we were younger, it was easy to find water on the street. There were drinking fountains everywhere. But over the past couple of decades, those drinking fountains, for the most part, have been removed, and there may be no drinking fountain within walking distance.
And one final question that we never touched on, and this doesn't relate to the subjects we were talking about earlier, but it's about mental illness and the difficulties of homelessness and poverty combined with mental illness on the street.
Certainly most of us have no idea how to deal with extreme poverty or homelessness. So for the most stable and happy among us, dealing with extreme poverty and dealing with living outside in the street will be distressing and will eventually lead to some degree of mental illness simply from the stress, the constant trauma, the violence. When a person falls into homelessness and poverty because they have a mental illness, whether it's a depression or an anxiety disorder or an autism disorder or psychosis, it's very, very complicated through the disturbed thinking to try to cope with poverty, to try to cope with homelessness, and to try to communicate with anyone else. They find themselves utterly isolated in that situation. There is very little in the way of psychiatric outreach into the street, and it is almost impossible to treat mental illness when a person is living in the street. Person I knew very well and cared a great deal about, Duncan Gisbrick, died this summer through an accidental overdose on his psychiatric medication. He, because he was living outside, did not keep regular sleep patterns. It's not possible to keep a regular sleep pattern when you're outside and disturbed constantly by security guards, police, people walking their dogs, sirens. Very easy to lose track of how recently you've taken your medication, of what hour of the day you're in, of what day of the week you're in. And those are very strong medications. Person needs quite a bit of regularity in their life, and certainly their own room, a place to store their medication, and to sleep regularly at night so that they recognize the change from one day to the next to be able to take psychiatric medication successfully.
And then, of course, there's a lot of controversy about psychiatric medication as well, whether or not that should be prescribed. I know certainly Dr. Abram Hoffer, who does orthomolecular medicine, has cured schizophrenia and bipolar just by giving people mega doses of certain nutrients, vitamin B, C, that he said people were deficient in. So, of course, this speaks loudly to the idea, and especially since homeless people, if they don't have money and they don't have access to clean water or water and they're dehydrated, if they're eating garbage food because that's all they can afford, they're bound to be deficient and they're bound to have mental illnesses. And is the solution really to put them on psychiatric medication that is perhaps not helping their situation, is having too many side effects, or just maybe we should just call them effects, that are not helping them get out of the situation?
You know, if you consider Maslow's hierarchy of needs, all homeless people are living in Maslow's basement. They don't even make it onto the scale. And there's no way to treat mental illness, whether through medication or through orthomolecular or through any other means, until a person is housed and receiving adequate nutrition and a decent amount of water. And those are the beginning points. And many people, once they're moved in, they're safe, they're sleeping regularly and know where their food is coming from, don't even need more treatment for the mental illness. Housing, food, water, sleep are therapeutic in themselves.
Yes, and what was also portrayed in some of these films too is that it is less expensive to put people in housing and with adequate support than it is to leave them on the street because of all the expenses, dealing with police officers or dealing with the court system, dealing with this and that, health issues. It's more expensive to leave them on the street, correct?
Well, it's more expensive to leave them on the street, of course, and it's more expensive because Police officers are not a solution for homelessness. The police officer can't house anybody. Only a nice, safe, warm building can house people. Ambulances don't house people. Hospitals don't house people. Psychiatric services don't house people. What people need, all people, all human beings on the face of the earth, need a little place to call their own. They need to be able to put a lock between themselves and the rest of the world at night while they sleep. All people need adequate nutrition. All people need water. All people need clean air.
Thank you so much, Judy. You are a wealth of information. I appreciate you talking with me.
Thank you very much.
That was Judy Graves. She is the coordinator of the Tenant Assistance Program at City Hall. This is Allard.
That whole conversation grew out of just one film at the Real Justice Film Festival, April 19, 2009, in Vancouver. The film was It Was a Wonderful Life. Our host, Allard, the producer of The Dynamic Health on CFRO, also interviewed Harold C. Joe, the filmmaker behind Broken Down. Find that interview in the Radio EcoShock Show for April 24th. Hear more of Allard's work at www.dynamichealthradio.info. This is CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio. It's listener-supported. Do you have your membership yet? Call the station or sign up online at our secure server at www.coopradio.org. I hope you'll do it. We need your support. Okay, let's get to our academic panel speakers at the Real Film Festival. We start off with the lively Krishna Pendekar, professor of economics at Simon Fraser University. He explains some of the basic facts of homelessness in Canada.
And I'm Krishna Pendekar. I'm in the Department of Economics at Simon Fraser. I have no connection to the real world. So what I want to briefly describe is just kind of what we know about what causes changes in the amount of homelessness that we have in our cities. Those of you who have lived in Vancouver for a long time must know in your bones that there's more of it than there was before, and that's correct. If you go back 20 years, there was virtually no homelessness in Vancouver, and indeed, there was virtually no homelessness in Canada. There's not a lot of information about the numbers of homeless people around in Canadian cities in different times and places, but we do know that there's a lot more. It's measured in the thousands now in Vancouver. And that's, you know, it's kind of a big number. And it's also a big change just in the last decade. There's been at least a doubling, possibly something like a tripling. There's a lot, and there's a lot more. So a reasonable thing is to ask why, or what at least is correlated with all these new people in the homeless population. And in Canada, we don't really have information like that because people haven't spent tons and tons of effort counting up homeless people. And that's kind of the first thing you have to do if you want to know what's causing changes in the numbers. In contrast, in the U.S., lots of people have spent lots of effort in this counting exercise over a long period of time over a lot of cities. And we do kind of have a set of answers. And just for context, I mean, if you've been watching movies all day, you must have seen that Our picture of homelessness and of people who are homeless is in large measure driven by, you know, the features of those people themselves. You see a lot of drug addiction, you see a lot of mental health issues, you see a lot of non-mental health issues, you see a lot of family breakdown, you see a lot of youngness, you see a lot of oldness. And that's true. The characteristics of homeless people are kind of different from the, characteristics of typical people in society. But if you ask, what's really at the core of driving the numbers of homeless people up and down across cities and over time, it really has not that much to do with that, those things, those usual culprits. And what you find is that the real drivers are, and this may come as a big surprise, high rent and low income. If you have low income and rents are high, you don't have enough money to buy shelter. And so the thing that in regular life, people face all these kinds of problems, and there's lots of mental illness out there, and there's family breakdown. There's all these things that happen to people. But if rents are kind of at a level that's reasonable, having these bad events happen to you does not toss you into the street. However, if rents are real high, having these bad events happen to you leads you to ending up in the street. So this is a key thing. High rent, low income. So that's the first thing. This is basically off, dozens and dozens of papers written on U.S. data. And I think it's really worth keeping in your mind because, whereas a lot of the other stuff seems so difficult and intractable, high rent and low income, that is not intractable. This is something for which we have policy tools. And interestingly enough, those policy tools were things that we used. We did a lot more redistribution of income towards people with very low incomes in the past. And there were kind of there was a big period of retrenching those kinds of transfers in the early 1990s, and we never really got out of that retrenchment. So one of the things that's different between now and 20 years ago, when there was virtually no homelessness in Canada, is that we transfer a lot less money to low-income households than we used to. This is a policy choice. We decided not to. We could decide to. So the second thing is, so that's really about incomes. There's another thing going on that's rents. In my view, the key reason we have high rents, this may come as a really big surprise, there aren't very many things to rent. And when there aren't very many things to rent, price goes up. So we have high rents in large measure, high rents at the bottom of the market, in large measure because there aren't a lot, the quantity of low rent spaces is not very big. And when there's not many low rent spaces, the rents on those low rent spaces kind of start to seem high. So that's what's been going on. You might ask, why has this been going on? Well, there are kind of two big reasons that we have high rents when we didn't used to. One reason that we have high rents now when we didn't used to so much is that in the early 1970s, a technology was invented, a legal technology, that made it so that people who were building big buildings didn't want to make them for rent anymore. They wanted to make them for selling. You know, you take a big building, you cut it up into pieces, and you sell those pieces. That was called the Condominium Act. Seemed good, right, because owning stuff is nice and all this sort of thing. But a side effect is that builders, private builders, did not want to build buildings for use as rentals. It was just a stupid thing to do because you can make way more money building them for owners, even though they're still chopped up into apartments. So this was kind of an invention. It had the side effect of totally killing off private building of rental units in Canada. That happened in the early 70s, and you can see that if you just look at the quantity of rental spaces, it just started, stopped increasing very fast. But at that time, governments built a lot of stuff for rent, and a lot of that stuff that governments built for rent was subsidized. There was federal government activity in the subsidized and building in the market for subsidized and built rental accommodation. And there was provincial activity, and there was even city-level activity in places like Toronto and Vancouver. So the thing is, in the early 1990s, the feds just decided they weren't into it anymore, so they quit. And then in the early 2000s, the province of BC decided they weren't into it anymore, and they quit. So you put all these things together, and you got a really strong push towards not having very many rental spaces available and not having new building, and you get this environment that we are currently in which it's expensive to rent spaces to live in. So the last thing I want to leave you with is that these are kind of policy choices we make. All these things I described are choices that we make collectively. They're choices about what the law should be, about how easy it is to make buildings that can be filled with rental spaces versus owned spaces, and they're policy choices about how much building should the government engage in and which level of government should be responsible. And these are policy changes that have moved in the direction over the last 20 years of having less stuff built, less stuff available, causing high rents, causing homelessness. We could undo all these. All we have to do is sort of say we want to. Well, there's an election coming. You have an opportunity to say you want to. Okay, that's me.
You are tuned to the Local Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio, Vancouver, Canada. That was Krishna Pendekar, Professor of Economics at SFU, speaking at the Real Justice Film Festival for Homelessness. Now we'll hear from Michelle Patterson, adjunct professor of health sciences at the University of British Columbia.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming. My research focuses on mental health and addiction through a policy lens, so that's the framework that I'll be couching my remarks under. So I'm going to just talk very briefly about some of the causes, consequences, and potential solutions related to homelessness from a mental health and addiction lens. So in terms of the causes, one of the things that are really important, I think, to remember are that the causes are very diverse and multidimensional. Homelessness I see as the tip of an iceberg. It is the result of a long trajectory, often a series of crises, including multiple losses, trauma, and dislocation that precedes it. So it's not just a point in time. There's definitely a long series of events and complicated events that precede it that need to be addressed. Some of the obvious causes are clearly have been mentioned: lack of affordable housing and inadequate income assistance. When $375 is the current shelter allowance and the average bachelor apartment costs $750, you can do the math very easily and see that it's very hard for someone to get housing. I think I just saw The Devil Plays Hardball again today, and just really that movie just really reiterated for me just some of the systemic barriers that get in the way, some of the real difficulties that the system puts in the face of people to just really make some simple steps forward. Related to that, what comes up again and again in my work are the silos of care. When we think about the healthcare system, particularly mental health and addiction services, which are often very separate, not to mention primary care, the justice system, income assistance, housing, all of these services come from very separate agencies and departmental jurisdictions, and there's not a lot of coordination between those systems. So homelessness really exists on the periphery of a lot of different complex, very big bureaucracies, and being able to integrate those services in a meaningful way that someone who is homeless and disconnected and potentially suffering from mental health and addiction problems, that makes getting help very difficult for that individual. So in terms of consequences, I think the consequences have been illustrated beautifully in the films we've seen today. People who are marginalized from their communities, from themselves, and from the wider system of care and support. We see often untreated mental illness, like chronic untreated mental illness, addiction, complex multiple medical problems, infectious disease, interpersonal difficulties and social anxiety and depression and a whole host of trauma and victimization related issues. I think on a system level perspective, the consequences are one of a kind of a focus on the crisis orientation. What do we do with this crisis in front of us? And as a result, there's a lot of stopgap solutions, and we get mired in the status quo as a result. So solutions, I think, to match the diversity and complexity of the causes, the solutions need to be complex. It's not just a simple solution of providing bricks and mortar. Yes, we need more housing, undoubtedly, but that housing needs to come with support. And we need to help people reintegrate into their community. And we need to support communities to build themselves and to really, there's a lot of resources and a lot of innovation within poor communities, particularly in the downtown east side. And how do we support communities to realize the innovation and answers that they have? There's an interesting, one of the models that we have been studying in the Faculty of Health Sciences is a model called Housing First, which really has developed in the United States, in New York City in particular, where they take people from the street and put them directly into housing with wraparound supports. And this is actually quite a radical approach, because people are not required to prove that they've been clean and sober or that they're ready for housing or ready for treatment. They approach people as they are, whether they want treatment or not, whether they have an addiction or not, and they provide housing and they really support people to stay in housing. And then finally, from a broader system perspective, I think we really need to pressure our government to break down some of the silos and to create a more integrated system of care. We need a more coordinated approach to dealing with the complex issues that homeless people are presenting. And so I think in terms of that system integration is made really complex because there's a lot of relationship building that we need to do. And while there are many and multiple wonderful agencies and people trying to help the homeless, I think that there are still a lot of vested interest. There's a lot of different ways of doing things, different philosophies that need to be overcome. And so I think we need to do more than just talk the talk. We need to really try and reach across those barriers and look at how we can really bring the silos and bring the barriers down.
That was Michelle Patterson from UBC, recorded April 19th at the SFU downtown campus by Alex Smith of CFRO. We'll wrap up today's economic panel on the homeless with a different perspective brought by Daniel Hebert, Professor of Geography at University of British Columbia.
Good afternoon, everyone. Krishna introduced me as a co-director of this thing called Metropolis British Columbia, but he didn't say exactly what it is, so I'll just spend 2 seconds saying it's a research center that deals with immigration and diversity. And I'm going to speak a little bit from that perspective, the perspective of newcomers who come to Vancouver and who find this society that has very high rents and, in many cases, quite low incomes for a lot of people who have just arrived. So that's where I'm going to start from. I would like to talk a little bit about the connections that happen between the international, the national, and the local, and just give you one, I think, very important example of how those connections take place, and an example that tells us something about how things are changing on our streets and in our neighborhoods. And to do that, I'm going to talk a little bit about immigration policy, very, very briefly. So in Canada, we have a kind of complicated immigration policy that has several different ways of people coming to Canada. Probably the thing that most people know about the most directly is the fact that Canada uses immigrants from an economic point of view and has an economic class of immigration, and you probably all heard that the term, the point system, which is used to decide which people should be coming and which ones should not. You probably all also have heard of family reunification, which is really quite a different kind of immigration, but it's allowing people to bring their family members to Canada over time. But the one I want to talk about a little bit more in detail is immigration in the form of protection for people, refugee protection. And so this is a deliberate policy that was created by Canada about 50, 60 years ago to begin to offer political asylum to people from around the world. And what Canada does is it brings in several different kinds of refugees from around the world. There's government-assisted refugees that Canada selects in refugee camps, typically, in different parts of the world. And there's also privately sponsored refugees. Canada, very interestingly, makes it possible for people from any organization to sponsor refugees if they wish to. That's an interesting development in our system. And then thirdly, there are people who just arrive in Canada and request asylum, refugee claimants that come here. I'll just talk a little bit about government-assisted refugees and give you a sense of how that's changed and what it means for life in Vancouver. So until quite recently, Canada had a kind of a principle in the way that it selected people to assist through bringing them to Canada and offering them refuge. And the principle was it prioritize people who would be seen as adaptable to Canada. So they looked for people who were well-educated, who had had jobs, and who could come and who were highly literate, who could come here and enter the job market relatively quickly. Then about 10 years ago, that principle began to change, and especially in the last legislation that was produced on something called the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act of 2002, Canada shifted its emphasis for government-assisted refugees from the principle of ability to adapt to the principle of highest need. So since that time, we've seen a larger and larger proportion of refugees that are being brought to Canada be people who have been in protracted refugee situations, who have been in camps for long periods of time, people who have not had very much formal education. In fact, quite a high proportion of the new refugee communities that are coming to Canada have not had any formal education. People who often have physical disability issues, people who often have very large families, which of course presents new challenges for housing, people who really are going to experience many challenges in terms of finding and securing housing and keeping it. And what's interesting about that massive policy shift that happened now 8, 9, 10 years ago is it was a very principled thing to do, in my opinion. It was a progressive move of the federal government to do that, but they offered no new resources to communities to deal with the new populations who are coming. And so in a place like Vancouver, where we receive about 1,000 government-assisted refugees every year, there's been no additional resources given to deal with the fact that the nature of those people has been changing quite a lot. I remember one of the first examples I heard of this some years ago when the policy change first happened was a family coming from Somalia where the family was 14 individuals and four of them were physically disabled and needed some form of well, wheelchairs or special access for the dwelling that they would occupy. How many places would exist that would accommodate that kind of that family with those kind of needs in Vancouver? Very, very few. So what that, of course, called for was a massive kind of effort on the part of the community to find solutions for that family, and this is occurring on a day-to-day basis. That leads me to another quick point I'll make. I'm probably already run out of time, but I just want to make a quick point. I think it was wonderful to see the films we've just seen, which, in my opinion, show us one window on one type of homelessness. We saw, you know, dance living on the street, sleeping on the street. That's a really important form of homelessness, but it's not the only form of homelessness. I think we have to think through other varieties of homelessness, people sofa surfing, living in people's living rooms, living in people's basements, and so on, people who are precariously housed. And that's really the case for the kind of population I'm talking about of new refugee families coming to Vancouver. You don't find very many of these people on the street. What you find is people dedicating enormously high proportions of their income to housing. I really need to say one other thing. I know my time is really short, but I need to say when Canada brings in a refugee from around the world as a government-assisted refugee, 6 months after they arrive, they're presented with a letter that says, now you must pay us back for the cost of transporting you to Canada. So the typical family will be on social assistance and will have a debt of anywhere from about $3,000 to $10,000. And when you're on social assistance and you're dealing with the kind of incomes that we just heard about a moment ago by Michelle, this can be a really traumatic experience to people who are already traumatized. So anyway, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the policy issues of bringing newcomers to Vancouver, particular changes that have happened, and things that have really strong on-the-ground kind of significance. And maybe I'll run out of time, so I'll leave for later some thoughts on some potential solutions to that.
That concludes our special on homelessness by the local brown bagger crew at CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. The Real Justice Film Festival was April 19, 2009, at the downtown campus of SFU. SFU sponsored the event along with Pivot and a team of downtown youth who were really super. There were 19 great films shown, many by local filmmakers. I just couldn't catch them all. They were fine films. I'd like to see the whole festival move to a lot of other towns as well. It's much needed. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. We'll go out with a bit of the song Dirty Town by Vancouver's own Mother Mother.
Don't like living in a dirty town, don't like living in a dirty town. I don't like living in a dirty town, cause a dirty town gets me down. I saved up and I bought some land, cause I can't stand living in a dirty town. Yeah, I pinch my pennies and I put them down, and I wash my hands of a dirty town. Plant my seeds in the ground, yeah, I put them down in my new brown land. Cause you can't plant seeds in a dirty town, no you can't plant seeds in a dirty town.
gone from a dirty town. Everybody now.
Get gone from a dirty town. Get gone from a dirty town.